Hi, everybody. My name's Otto.
Hey,
I'm a grateful member of the Al-Anon family groups. I'm going to set my little clock here so that I don't put you all to sleep. What time do we need to go home? 3 o'clock. Okay. It's easy when you know how. All right. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a delightful weekend. It's nice to see a full house. It's nice to be able to talk. I've been paranoid all weekend that I wouldn't be able to get up here and speak because I've had a persistent cough, and it didn't go away until the rain last night. And the rain knocked all the pollen out of the air, and la-da! the pressure's off, and I'm happy to be able to come and share my story with you. And I want to thank Joycey and for being on time at the airport and for being such gracious hosts. We hadn't quite gotten from the airport to here before I'd already told Joycey a lie, trying to defend myself against the alcoholic, you know. But I copped to it before the day was over. So anyway, it's been a great weekend. I'm trying to get caveman out of my head. You know, got to get the caveman out of my head. Otherwise, I'm not gonna tell you my story. If you don't feel like a caveman, you know, hang in here. I keep seeing that commercial on TV where the cavemen are sitting there ordering the duck and the I'll have the Peking duck, you know. I just can't get it out of my head. So I'm gonna have to work to get my story out of here. You know, just keep pumping and get it. Okay. I'm originally from Oklahoma, and I missed that. I grew up in Oklahoma City, and really? How's that? No? Originally, I'm from Oklahoma City. I was born and raised there, and I thought that was the big city for a long time. I grew up in a family a little different from Bob's. I had an older sister and two younger brothers. My father was a police officer. My mother was a postal clerk. We lived in a small home, about 900 square feet, two bedrooms, one small bath, and it was right outside of the second turn of the speedway where the dirt jalopies would race. And when the race cars would come around the corner, they'd throw mud in our front yard. You know it's prime real estate. Okay. So, you know, I never knew we were poor because my father, being a police officer, had special privileges. And he was all the time bringing home new bicycles and puppies. And, you know, when we would go to the circus, we'd get to go sit on the front row, and we'd be the ones that got to get in the calliope and ride around with the clowns at the circus, you know, because we're Freddy's kids. We were special. And my dad was my first higher power. You know, if Dad said it, it was the law. I grew up with a lot of crazy, alcoholic thinking. My father and my mother both drank to excess. When my mom and dad would drink, they would fight. And I saw my father hit my mother many, many times. And I can remember opening up the bedroom door and looking down into the converted garage and seeing my dad on my mom's chest with his knees pinning her shoulders to the bed and hitting her in the face with his fist and blood just everywhere. And he pointed at me and told me to get back to my room, and I'd go. And my sister and my brothers and I would get up the next day and we'd act like nothing happened. You don't say nothing. You don't rock the boat. Now, I went to school and you'd never know the home I was living in, because school was my safe place. School was where I ran to. In school, I was top team. I was friendliest boy. I was class president. I was in student council. I played all the sports. I emceed the pep rallies. I headed up the paper drives, and the teachers gave me gifts when I graduated. Now, that's quite a feat, because I'm the only member of my family of six to graduate from high school. Neither of my parents had a high school education. My older sister dropped out, and both my younger brothers dropped out of high school before they completed it. There was so much chaos in the home that we grew up in. There was so much fear. When Bob talked about the psoriasis last night, psoriasis is rampant in my family. The nerves and the stress and the tension and the anxiety and the fear that were commonplace in our home. Had a lot of rules. Big boys don't cry. Don't you cry. I'll give you something to cry about. Don't be afraid. You shouldn't be afraid. Don't feel bad. If you feel bad, there's something wrong with you. Always tell the truth. That was my favorite rule. Truth will get you killed at my house. You know. Gee, Dad, you know, it just really scares me to death when you hit Mom, you know. And I was a lot brighter than Bob. Bob's a big boy and he's hiding under a table. Give me a break. I'm in the closet. I'm under the bed. Ooh-wee. Quitters never win. Winners never quit. Exceptions are made for exceptional people. Practice makes perfect. Where there's a will, there's a way. You can do anything you put your mind to. Exceptions are made for exceptional people. And I thought this was the truth. These are the rules that I grew up with. Those were the spoken rules. There were a lot of unspoken rules where I grew up, and I carried these rules into my adult life. You know, like we communicate through innuendo and insinuation. You never say what you really mean to say. If I want a soda, I would say to my partner, my spouse, "Honey, are there any Cokes in the refrigerator?" I don't ask, "Would you get me a Coke?" Because she might say no, and oh my God, then all hell's going to break loose, you know. So I don't run that risk. You know, are there any Cokes in the refrigerator? And she knows there's Cokes in the refrigerator. And if she wants to get me one, she'll say, "Well, sure, honey, let me get you one." And if she doesn't want to get me one, she says, "I don't know." So we never have to take any risks. You know, risk taking is out of, we don't ever get out of the box at my house, you know. We give each other generic cards. You know, when you send Dad the Father's Day card or you send Mom a Mother's Day card, you're looking through the Hallmark section, you know, and they got these, "You were the most loving and kind. You were always there for me," and I also, you know. You know, and you got to find one that just says "Happy Father's Day." Yeah, okay. Yeah. Now that one I can send on over there, you know. I remember I was at my dad's one time, and he and my older sister had been estranged for many, many, many years. And she reached out to him, and she sent him a generic Father's Day card, and she signed it, "Love, Anna." And my dad looked at that card and he went, "What do you think she means by that?" I'm not kidding. She put "love" on it. She should have just put "Anna." You know, it had to be something sarcastic in there. Hidden agenda everywhere. We give each other alcohol and drugs for Christmas and for birthdays. You know, that's birthday parties are held at the tavern. And if I wanted to spend any time with my dad when he wasn't working, I went to the tavern. And I grew up hanging out in taverns so that I could spend time with my dad. My dad, you know, worked a couple, three jobs to try to make ends meet. And he'd be tired or he'd be intoxicated. So by the time I was 10, I was a night watchman, you know, because he'd take me with him to wherever he was pulling watch, and he'd go to sleep or pass out, whichever the case might be. And I'd be the night watchman all night. And I can't tell you how terrified I've been of the dark my whole life. You know, I've had a sleep disorder, I think, my whole life. Just fear of the dark, fear of the fighting that would take place at night when my folks would come home. And the fear of those night watchman jobs. You know, running around in those dark buildings with a flashlight as a little kid. They give you a key. And you put this key in a box and you have to turn it each hour. And there are boxes all throughout the buildings. On the fairgrounds, there's boxes all throughout the big factory buildings and whatnot, and you have to run through and show that he's been there. You know, so I'm covering for the alcoholic when I'm 10, you know, and I'm pulling guard duty. But I've always been a very responsible person, and I like being in charge, and I don't like when you're in charge because I don't trust you. You know, it seems like things don't work out real well when I'm not in charge. So that's why I was class president, top dean, and the student council and everything. Matter of fact, I just came back from my 40th high school reunion. It was really a good time. I had a good time in high school. And when I first came to Al-Anon, I was attending my 20th high school reunion. And, of course, I was the MC. You know, I'm in charge of entertainment. I went to a big school, and there are more people than this at this reunion. We had like 500 people at this class reunion. I went to a big school. And, of course, I'm just real happy to be a part of it and excited to be back amongst all my friends, you know, someplace where I was cool and well thought of and held in high regard. And I was having a lot of fun emceeing the entertainment and the band and the dinner and everything's going on. But one of the things we did is we had a balloting. And people had a chance to vote for the classmate that had changed the most, the classmate that changed the least and whatnot. And, you know, we found out who came the furthest and who had the most kids. And we had one, what we thought was a real nice award, though, and it was for the Oh, What a Night Award. We were the Northwest Knights. And it was the Oh, What a Night Award for the classmate everyone enjoyed seeing the most. We're still kids. And I'm up handing out albums from the 60s and giving these awards out to all the winners. And we get to the Oh, What a Night Award, and I open up the envelope, and there's my name. Oh, this big boy's going to cry. I mean, I am so touched. I am so moved. I'm just trying to say thank you, but it's been a hard life, y'all. It's been hard. And I got tears running down my face, and I'm blowing snot bubbles out of my nose. Just trying to say thank you, and I had to be helped to my seat. All I ever wanted is for y'all to love me and like me, you know. I had such a wonderful evening all night long. People come pat on me. Oh, Otto, we're so glad you're here. It's so good to see you. And I was just, oh, God is good, you know. God is good. We're cleaning up after the dance and going up to the hospitality room, and I happen to be cleaning up the registration table because I'm a helper. And I picked up the ballot box, and on the ballot box was the tally sheet, and on the tally sheet was the truth. Now, God's got some real gentle ways. He's been nudging me along, you know, helping me to learn some truths about myself, but this one was a shocker. On the tally sheet, turns out of all those people at that reunion, only 25 bothered to cast a ballot. The other 475 didn't give a damn what the committee had done. I'm sorry, Mary. Yeah. They were there with their own agenda to see the people they wanted to see to do their own thing. And of the 25 ballots cast, 23 of my classmates got one vote each, and I got two. And so the person counting the ballots, you know, wrote me down because I had the most votes. When they sent it up there, well, you know, it was me. And this has been a big problem with me my whole life. You know, is when I see something, when I feel something, when I think something, I think it is. I pretty much think, feel, and think that my way of thinking, feeling, and thinking is the standard unit of measure. It's the truth. It's reality. Thanks for playing our game, Otto. We have some lovely parting gifts for you. But I did not know that until I was 38 years old at my 20-year high school reunion. God gently said, Otto, don't take yourself so serious. Wow. It was a wonderful gift to get right. And at my 25-year reunion, I told that story. You know, and after 6 years in Al-Anon, I was able to tell them that, you know, it wasn't as important for them to love me as it was that I loved them. And that was the truth. But I'm still enjoying my class reunions. Anyway, but anything I see, feel, or think, just, you know, take it with a grain of salt, okay? My mom and dad married and divorced. And married and divorced, and married and divorced each other three times before I got out of high school. They couldn't live with each other. They couldn't live without each other. Now, my sister's married and divorced and married and divorced, and I'm married and divorced and married and divorced, and my brothers are married and divorced and married and divorced and married and divorced. We don't know how to have relationships. We don't know how to get along, you know, because everybody doesn't know the rules that we grew up with, you know, and everybody can't speak that language of innuendo and insinuation, you know. Everybody doesn't know what a generic card looks like. You know, some people want to, you know, confront you with the truth and, you know, get it out of here. I ain't going to hear none of that. No one in my family of origin ever said I was wrong. No one ever said, I'm sorry. I never heard that. It wasn't in the language. It was, oh, I was just kidding. I was just kidding. I didn't mean it. Nobody owned nothing. So these are the tools I took with me when I left home and I went off to college. And I was excited about going to college. But getting out from under the rule, the heavy thumb of my father, I played way too much when I went to college. And I'm not that bright. You know, the gene pool in my family, there's no diving, okay? No diving in the gene pool. So we're only allowed to wade. So not doing well in school, I got drafted into the service. And it wasn't a good time to get drafted. You know, the Vietnam War was raging. And I did everything I could do to avoid going to war.
I'll fix it. I was trying not to go to war.
Determined to send me. I can fix everything. Now, be Being the leader that I am, I went to NCOCS and became a Betty Crocker sergeant because I didn't want to go into combat as a follower. I'd much rather go as a leader. And I went to jump school and I did everything. I went down here to Fort Benning and I did everything I could do to avoid going to Vietnam. But I got to where I just had 1 year left to serve and I had to go. And my Vietnam experience was short but awful. And what's going on over in Iraq right now causes me a great deal of grief. And I get counseling twice a month at the vet center to help me cope with the emotions that this war conjures up for me. I saw and did horrible things. And we'd gone in on an air assault with just weapons and water because we knew the enemy was going to be there one day, and they were, and they just beat hell out of us. And the second day of that contact with the North Vietnamese Army, I walked up on an enemy position and a short burst of machine gun fire rang out and I was hit twice. And if you've ever heard the expression, we're going to blow your ass off, that's exactly what happened to me. I carry my billfold over here so it looks like I got something going on, you know, because nobody's home over there, you know. I always sit on this side, you know. But anyway, I lost my left hip joint. Both rounds went right through the joints. I lost my left ankle joint. And as I lay there on the ground, realizing what has happened to me, you know, when that happens, it happens so fast, you don't know that you have to stop and catch up with the events that have transpired, you know. And it's like, I've been shot. And my second thought was, God help me. And my third thought was, there is no God. And on September 22nd, 1968, I was so fed up with the God of my understanding that in that moment of desperation, I was unwilling to turn to Him. And I became a self-propelled, self-reliant man on September 22nd, 1968. You know, I had been to church, I had wondered, I had pondered, I had sought to know. You know, I went to Sunday school and I sang. And it was confusing for me. And, you know, in my house, we don't ask questions. My little brother Jack was so affected by the chaos in our home that he spent years in children's convalescent hospital with colonitis, ulcers of the intestines. The stress was so great on the children. And we'd go out to visit him, you know, and there's thalidomide babies, and there's cancer kids, and there's kids that have been burned, and amputees, and all these sick children out at this hospital. And then I'd go to Sunday school, and we'd sing, Jesus loves the little children. And I'm thinking, well, he needs to get to the hospital. And, you know, it was confusing to me. And, you know, one Sunday we went to church and the pastor at our church didn't show up. He was a wonderful man. I used to love to listen to Bill Alexander preach, you know, but he perished in a plane crash the night before. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, what good did God do him? Here's God's right-hand man. And it did him no good whatsoever. He perished in a plane crash, you know. I thought he'd be protecting Bill, you know. See, I had a lot of questions, but I stopped asking the questions on September 22nd, 1968. I'd just seen too much. I had just seen too much horror in war. And as I lay there bleeding to death, the enemy got out of their hole. I was laying about for me to marry away from that weapon. And they got out of their hole and they came and they stripped my watch off my wrist. They took a knife and cut the straps off my ruck and pulled it off of me. My helmet was gone. They took my weapon and they went and they got back in their hole. And I could feel that gun pointed at the top of my head. And in that desperate situation, I was not willing to consider that maybe I needed a little divine intervention to help me out. I survived the firefight that ensued, and a real brave young man named Dwayne Grendel crawled up under that gun and pulled me down and saved my life. And I found him from one of these podiums 2 years ago. I was able to tell him thank you for what he did, and I wanted to tell his family too, but his family had all passed. Anyway, they dusted me off, sent me to a hospital in Yokota, Japan. I was there 7 weeks. They sent me to a hospital in California, hospital in Texas, and I finally wound up at a hospital, Reynolds Army Hospital, Fort Sill, Oklahoma, so I could be close to my family. You need that family support, you know. When I turned 21, I'd been in the hospital 4 months. When I turned 22, I was still laying there. I had a gross staph infection that would not heal, and they just kept cutting pieces of me off. You know, they did a fusion of my left ankle, and they tried to fuse my left hip. But it just would not fuse because of the pins that aggravated the infection, and they couldn't take the pins out because they couldn't let the hip move. I spent 9 months in a body cast, a plaster from my chest down. My whole body in plaster, can't move anything but my arms for 9 months. They had to cut my little titties off because the cast irritated them and rubbed them, you know. It was just miserable, just living, can't move. They had to give me all my injections in my arm, you know. They can't shoot me in the buttocks or anywhere, and my arms were so badly scarred, and my veins are all collapsed, and the pain was just awful. You know, you could hear the needle go into my shoulders, and they're so scarred, it's like injecting balsa wood. And I'd just cry because the morphine or whatever would just run back out around the needle and down my arm, and I suffered terribly. You know, but my dad was always there. Don't you cry. Don't you be afraid. It's hard to even remember that. Got married laying there in the hospital in that cast. They told me I wouldn't walk again, so I didn't want that cute little high school sweetheart to get away. I figured I better grab her before she finds out. And her parents weren't very excited about it. She's still a senior in high school, but she and a couple of my friends drove down to the hospital, and the pastor came up to the room and married us as I lay there in my hospital bed. And then they give me a one-night pass, and this cast had a big old bar between the legs to keep it stiff, so you can't put pants or anything on. So they took a pair of cut-off jeans, and they put eyelets up both sides, and they put it on me like a diaper, and then they laced it up with shoelaces so that I have cut-offs on, and then they just put a big sweatshirt over the top of it, and my friends carried me out of the hospital, threw me in the back of a pickup truck on a mattress, off to the Holiday Inn, me and my new bride, my bedpan and my urinal, and my two best friends. And yes, we did consummate that marriage. Then she went back home to her mom and daddy, and it was another year before I was able to come and live with her. Where there's a will, there's a way. Come on, did y'all learn the rules? I went to college. I was very angry as an angry vet. Angry because all my friends had graduated from college and gone on and started careers, and here I'm going to college, you know, on crutches. I had an open draining wound in my buttocks for 7 years. For 7 years I had pus running out of my buttocks, and I'd wear big gauze bandages over here so it wouldn't run out on my clothes. And the pain was awful. It never, the pus, the open pustules went away when they finally took the screws out at 7 years. But at 7 years, it hadn't fused solid. And I had just enough motion, bone-on-bone motion, about 5 degrees worth, to just hurt like hell. And I could walk on it, but it was very painful. And I felt pretty sorry for myself. And I was an angry vet. And I've always felt kind of like I was on the short end of the stick, something of a victim, you know, when being a high-profile kid in school and trying really hard, and all the other kids, when they would dance in the assemblies, they'd have white slacks and these fancy shoes, and they'd wear, you know, we'd dye our T-shirts to match the color of the girls' shirts, and they'd wear their little cheerleader skirts, and we'd dance in front of the school. Well, I didn't have white slacks. You know, my mom would go up to the Anthony's, and she'd buy painter's pants, and then she'd work real hard to tailor them so that they would look like slacks. But I was always embarrassed. You know, I always felt less than. I never felt like I measured up. It didn't matter how many awards or how many citations or how many records I set or what kind of grades I made or how many hits I got or how many touchdowns I scored. It did not matter. There was nothing that was going to convince me that I was okay, because it just seemed like no matter how hard I tried, I could not please my father. I could not cause peace in my home. And I could not maintain a relationship. You know, and when my dad left for the last time, then my little brother Jack, who'd come out of that convalescent hospital, he's battering my mother. He's beating my mom. And so she calls me because I'm the hero child. I'm the good kid in the family. And, you know, come to find out, he's living in the doghouse behind my mom's house. We had big Doberman pinchers. We always had big, mean dogs. She'd found him one night staggering around in the backyard where he'd been huffing paint. Spraying paint in a bag, huffing paint. And she brought him in, and he beat her up and tore the house up. She called me again, and I went down there again and called the police again, and they took him to jail again. And this time I went before the judge because they served a warrant on him for using stolen credit cards. And I told the judge, I said, "Your Honor, please don't give my brother probation. Don't let him go. Please help my brother, help my mother. I'm sleeping with a pistol for fear of my own brother. My mother's been battered over and over again. He almost killed my uncle recently just because he tried to give him a job. My brother needs help." Now, I knew nothing about alcoholism, drug addiction. I knew nothing about it. I just thought my brother was bad. He's just bad. You know, so lock him up, put him somewhere where maybe he'll get some help, some psychiatric help. And this judge said, "This is really an unusual request. You know, the family usually wants some kind of leniency or something, you know." And 2 years state penitentiary. Sent him to Big Mac, McAllister, Oklahoma. And I thought, whew, now we'll get some rest. You know, now we can take a break. Now we can take it easy. At least for a couple of years anyway. Well, what actually happened was they put my brother to work painting. Whoever made that sign, you did a real nice job, and thank you. No, you really did. I know how hard that is because I've done that. But they put my brother to work painting. And so guess what? You know, he gets high. He gets high. And they transfer him back to maximum security. And in a holding cell there, he hanged himself. And he took his life. And I felt so responsible. And I don't know if you've ever experienced the shouldas. But I should have called. I should have visited. I should have wrote. I should have done more. I should have known. I should have thought of this. I should have. I should have. I should have. And I've, you know, at the funeral, my dad didn't come. My mom, she hadn't stopped crying since he left the courtroom. You know, and all the onus was on me. Because, see, it was my idea. Seems like, you know, no matter how hard I try to help people, it just never seemed to work out for me. My intentions are good. You know, I'm a good guy. All I've ever wanted to be is a good son, a good father, a good brother, a good husband, good neighbor, good soldier, good citizen. I'm trying. I really am. I'm trying the best I can. And everything I touch turns to crap. You know, I can't even be a soldier. I get my ass blown off. You know, I get lost in the jungle, walk up and get shot. You know, give me a break. I can't do anything right. And so now my other little brother, Carl, he's in trouble with the law. You know, he's drinking and he's drugging. He's a Vietnam vet and he's disturbed. And they catch him on the south side of Oklahoma City stopping traffic. He's dressed in a full army uniform. He's got a pistol. He stops traffic. He pulls a guy out of a car. He pistol whips him and tells him he wants to be taken to see the president. They arrested him. My little brother's the biggest brother. And he's huge, but he's got these Charlie Manson eyes. You do not want to mess with my little brother Carl. Everyone's afraid of my little brother Carl, except me. And I'm not about to let them send Carl to Jack's fate. So once again, I get on my white horse and I ride into the middle to make sure that this all turns out all right. I just happen to be dating the competency court judge's clerk. I'm between marriages, okay? So she takes me in to visit the competency court judge, and he assures me that if I will make arrangements to have my brother taken to a military hospital, he will commit him, as opposed to letting him go through the criminal process. Whew. So I go to all the people involved and get them to come to the court to testify. Nobody wants to. They're all afraid of my brother. They bring my brother in handcuffs. He is not happy. It's been a few days since he's had anything to drink. It's been a few days since he's had anything to take. He's not pleased to be there. And he meets his court-appointed defender, and they set him down, and they call the court to order. They call the first witness, Otto Merz. Would you please step to the stand? I step up there. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And would you tell us what you saw that day? Well, I didn't see anything. I wasn't there. You know, but everybody who did is right outside that door. And the little public defender says, Your Honor, I'm sorry, but this is the only name that appears on the petition. And Mr. Merz is the only person entitled to testify. I move for dismissal. And the judge looked over at me and shook his head. Released the defendant. Oh, my gosh. And they turned this wild man loose. And everybody out in the hall is mad at me. You know, I didn't know I was supposed to get them to sign the petition, too. I mean, I just can't do it right. No matter how hard I try, it just doesn't seem to work. My little brother Carl has been incarcerated 3 times. You know, the first time he came out of prison, I was in this program. And I said, Carl, you're going to... I went to his family week. They had a CAP program, chemical assistance program, while he was in the prison. And I went and I participated. And I said, Carl, you're going to love the people in AA. You're just going to love the people in AA. And he says, oh, I'm not going to AA. I have a drug problem. I don't have a drinking problem. Back out he went. Back to prison he went. I go visit him in prison because I'm writing and I'm visiting now, and I'm taking Mama to see him. And he gets out the second time and he says, "Oh, Otto, I'm not going to go to that A&A." He says, "I got a drinking problem. I don't have a drug problem. Yeah, but I don't think I think I cannot drink by myself." Third time he goes to prison, he came out. He swore, I am going to AA. I am going to AA. And he got out, and I called him, and I said, you know, there's meetings. There's meetings over here. He said, I don't care to go. And he's never been yet. So. Unfortunately, none of my family has found recovery. Yeah. But the good news is, they don't have to for me to recover. You know, that's the good news. Because while all this insanity is going on, while all this chaos goes on at every level of my family, whether it's brother, sister, son, cousin, nephew, grandkids, whatever, I mean, it just permeates my family. Christmas is the holiday from hell at our house, John. No, Santa doesn't come to our house. Squad cars come to our house on Christmas Day. You know, people get arrested at my house on Christmas Day. Christmas is the holiday from hell. You know, everybody's got extended families with all these divorces, and every grandparent and second and half cousin, and everybody wants to see these kids on Christmas Day, and it's like a track meet. You know, you start out, and it's not like climbing a family tree. We're running through the family thicket. You know, it's just one of the greatest gifts I gave myself in recovery was when I stopped going home for Christmas, and that's the truth. It was so hard. Because I knew it would hurt my mother's feelings for me not to come home and be a part of that chaos and that insanity. It was one of the most courageous and healthy things I've ever done, was to stay home and take care of myself and have a nice Christmas. Anyway, Al-Anon has changed my life. If all there was for me to cope with these people and learn how to cope with them and do the best I could, all I had was the rules I grew up with. And they didn't work. You know, all they'd done was get me divorced twice. But in Al-Anon, I took these steps and changed my life. The steps, you know, they're simple. They're not easy, but they're very simple. And the purpose of taking the 12 steps and the reason why they work for us is because the purpose is to have a spiritual awakening. You know, a lot of people think the 12 steps, you work the 12 steps to get sober. That's what alcoholics do. They work the 12 steps and they get sober. No. No. Anybody who works the 12 steps has a spiritual awakening. That's the desired result, not a result, one of many. The result of working the 12 steps is a spiritual awakening. And I was spiritually bankrupt when I came to you. I'd been that self-propelled man for a long time. You know, and I had run out of relationships. I was estranged from my family, from my children. I was so angry at everyone for not being able to do it right. And you guys just saved me. I can't say anything more than that other than you just saved me. You brought me in when I didn't know, and you told me I didn't have to know. You know, there weren't any pledges I had to learn. There wasn't anything I had to memorize. I didn't have to learn the clothing. All I had to do was just show up. You know, and you guys loved me till I couldn't love myself. And I met a wonderful man who became my mentor, and he was a guide for me through these steps. And I immediately started to get relief as soon as I began to try to embrace these steps as a program of living. Because that first step says that I'm powerless over alcohol and that my life is unmanageable. And what that did was that said that I'm not a screw-up, which is what I had believed I was my whole life. I had believed I was a failure and that I'm less than and that I can't do it right and that I'm stupid and that I can't catch a break and that life's not fair. That's what I believed. I had no idea. No one had ever told me. I had never learned that, you know what, Otto, your life is just unmanageable. Your best plans don't work. That's the way it is for everyone, son. Practice doesn't make perfect. Where there's a will, there's more often a conflict than a way. It was relief for me. It was good news. Yippee! I'm powerless! Yay! Oh, wow, thank you. You know, every life is unmanageable. Every life is unmanageable. The lion that can't catch the little deer and goes hungry, his life's unmanageable. The little deer that can't outrun the lion and becomes dinner, his life is unmanageable. That wasn't his plan for the day when he got up. Every life is unmanageable, but when you live in the insanity and the chaos of alcoholism, when you've been affected by alcohol and other people's drinking the way I have, then we get more than our fair share of unmanageability, because 2 and 2 is 5, and that's up and that's down in an alcoholic home. Whew. Came to believe in power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. My nickname was Crazy Otto. I had no problem. Blew right through that. Made a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. God. God. I looked at those 12 steps. God. God, 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 God damn. It's a God deal. I can't believe it. I can't believe it. I get to meet all you fine, wonderful people, and you just like church. Damn, I can't believe it. I don't believe in God. You know, you hoodwinked me, you duped me, you just deceived me. I can't believe this is a God deal. I was angry. I was angry. I don't believe in God. And a wonderful guy, you know, a young guy, he says, Otto, he says, I was telling him all the reasons why I couldn't believe in God. You know, if there's a God, he must be a terrorist. Okay? I mean, look at the war. Look at the war in Vietnam. Look at tornadoes and hurricanes and floods. Look at all the tragedy and trauma in the world. You know, look at my mom and my dad. Look at my brothers. You know, if there's a God, where the hell's he been? You know? And I told him about that day in Vietnam when I was shot, and I made a conscious decision that there was no God. And he said, he gave me a real nice gift. He said, Otto, you don't have to believe in the God you gave up on in Vietnam. Now, where he got the wisdom to tell me that, I don't know, but those were magic words for me because that let me out of the corner I'd painted myself into. It gave me an opportunity to look again. And he asked me, he says, What would God have to be for you to take a chance, Otto, and try and turn your will and your life over to His care? Now, I thought that was a ridiculous proposal. I thought I was always supposed to figure out what God wanted me to be. You know, what do I have to do to win grace? What do I have to do to win my Father's favor? You know, I thought God was like my earthly father. But He's not. What I've come to know is that God loves me because He's God, not because I'm good, not because of anything I do. God loves me because He's God. And you guys loved me because you're loving people. I wasn't lovable when I came into these rooms. I was angry and confused and desperate. You know, if I'd have been a drowning man, I'd have pulled you under with me. But you all swam out and pulled me to shore. You all loved me because you understood and you were loving people, and I didn't have to do anything to earn it. You know, it's a wonderful gift to learn what altruism is. You know, there had been strings attached to everything I ever did or ever received my whole life. And in here I found no strings attached. And what a wonderful gift you gave me. I did an inventory. I stopped being a victim. You know, my sponsor told me, he says, I'll write down a list of everybody that ever screwed you over or pissed you off. I can do that. Got that down here in a hustle. Yeah, okay. You bet. Yeah, I was disappointed. I got 99 people, places, and organizations. I wanted 100, but I couldn't. I said 99. He says, okay, now write down why that made you angry. I said, well, look what they did. He says, yeah, that's what they did. Why'd that make you angry? I said, look what they did. He says, well, why'd that make you angry? Okay, let's take one. She left me for another man. Why'd that make you angry? She left me for another man. That's what she did. Why'd that make you angry? He says, Otto, if you'd been trying to get rid of her and she wouldn't go, and then all of a sudden she left you for another man, you'd be excited. Yeah. He says, well, then it's not her leaving that makes you angry. It's the fact that you didn't want her to go. You know, when you don't get your way, when people don't do as you would have them do, you get angry. You become afraid. And you cop a resentment. I went down through every one of those. There wasn't a one of them where anybody was doing what I wanted them to do. There wasn't a one of them where I was getting my way. You know what? When I don't get my way, I get angry. I've been kind of godlike. Godlike my whole life. I thought it was toilet paper. Then he had me write down, you know, what was my part in each one of these deals? You know, and I found out that I'm intolerant, I'm impatient, I'm demanding, I'm controlling, I'm righteous, I'm slothful, I'm envious, I'm greedy, I'm punishing, I'm demanding. I had no idea. I just thought I was a good guy trying to make good things happen for everybody. I had no idea that the reason all my relationships were so distant was I'd been treating them all like a tiddlywink. You know, the more pressure I put on them, the further away they squirt. You know, if I just stop pushing on them to be where I stay and do what I want them to do, then they don't tend to run off the way they do. And I'm happy to say that today I've been with the same woman for over 18 years. And we still like each other. That's important. We still like each other and we still do nice things for each other. Paul O taught me a lot about how to have a relationship. You know, he came to our club and spoke. And going to those open AA meetings is a big help, folks. If you don't go to open AA meetings, you need to go. Because Dr. Paul and his wife Maxine came and spoke at the club where my Al-Anon group is, and I went to both the AA speaker and the Al-Anon speaker, and I heard Paul O. talk about doing things for Max, expecting nothing in return. You know, replacing the perfectly good porcelain sink with the steel sink she wanted. You know, expecting nothing in return. And I understood for the first time, you know, how it was to love somebody, you know. My wife and I today, we do things like I like coffee in the morning and she likes coffee in the afternoon. So she goes to work before I get up, and when I get up, the coffee's ready. She's made it for me. Isn't that sweet? I just have to have a cup of coffee. And I bust my butt to get home and make sure that the coffee's ready when she gets home from work. You know what? So when she gets home from work, she don't have to make coffee. It's ready. Isn't that sweet? So she makes coffee once a day, and I make coffee once a day, but we make it for each other. See? And we like that. Now, some mornings I get up and there's no coffee. What does that mean? Now, if you read between the lines and if you communicate with innuendo and insinuation, that means she's mad about something. But my wife and I don't live that way. What it means is there's no coffee. Because if my wife has a problem with me, she'll say so. And if I've got a problem with her, I'll say so. And we'll say it in a civil tone, and we'll resolve it. I can't believe I've been up here an hour. Oh, I just love to talk about this program. Fast forward. I found out that, you know, I am afraid. I didn't know until I did an inventory that I am afraid. I believed, like my father taught me, that I shouldn't be afraid, therefore I am not. And what it was is I just never owned my fear. I'm afraid of everything. And my sponsor told me, he says, just write down something on that pad. So I wrote down spiders, snakes, the dark. Man, and it just started flowing out. And I'm afraid of everything. You know, I'm afraid you won't laugh when I'm trying to be funny. I'm afraid you will laugh when I'm not trying to be funny. I'm afraid I'm going to be in pain. I'm afraid I'm going to be alone. I'm afraid you're not going to like me. I'm afraid I'm going to get lost. I'm afraid of everything. And what a relief to find out what these feelings are inside of me. I never knew until I took this inventory. You know, I knew two emotions when I got to you, happy and pissed. You know, and you guys have taught me a whole range of emotions. It's wonderful. I took a sex inventory and I stopped being a deviant. You know, and my wife and I have a very nice, healthy, wholesome sex relations today. And we're monogamous. I've been monogamous for over 20 years. And I like that, you know. I like that. And I come in here and I see all you beautiful Georgia peaches and I think, Anyway, everyone in my family has benefited from my recovery. Even though the others don't participate, everyone has benefited. Because I practice these principles in all my affairs, and it's terrific. You know, I mean, I've had the addicted child. We went through the unwanted pregnancies at 15. This is all while I'm coming to your meetings and hanging on to you guys and going, what did we do? What did we do? I'm calling my sponsor, Johnny, what did we do? Tina's pregnant. God, we just had the talk. I mean, what, you know, I mean, I thought we were doing so good and being open and candid and communicating and whatnot. And she told me she didn't need it. Yeah, I don't know. You know. He says, I don't know. He says, I've never had a daughter pregnant. You know, and if you've got a good sponsor, if they don't have experience with what you're dealing with, they don't know. If you've got a sponsor that makes stuff up, you might want to shop a little. You know? You know, don't make up answers, folks. We don't make up answers in here. We share our experience, strength, and hope. My sponsor helped me find someone who'd had a pregnant daughter. And I could go to Ben and I could say, Ben, what'd you do? And he didn't tell me what to do. He told me what he did. and how it turned out. And I could ask him questions, you know, like, God, we don't know whether or not to tell her grandma. It's going to kill her grandma. Her grandma will die if she finds out that Tina's pregnant. You know, she'll just die. Ben says, well, we didn't tell Amy's grandma. She found out anyway. Damn near killed her. That's one thing I like about it. You know, nobody tells me what to do in here. I don't like to be told what to do. I don't know about you. I don't like people to tell me what to do. Tell me what you did. Tell me what you did and how it turned out. Everything's been made better in my life. Just one example. My stepson, Matt. When his mother and I married, he was 10. He's a good kid. But he was 10. And so anyway, I'm out in the yard, and I got this little dog, and I like to throw the ball off the fence, and the dog will chase after it, you know, and I like to play keep away from the dog. And Matt says, can I throw the ball, Otto? Can I throw the ball? And I said, yeah, you know, but be careful. Don't throw it over the fence. Don't throw it over the fence. The Wicked Witch of the West lives on the other side of the fence. The problem neighbor lives on the other side of the fence. There's a big hedge you can't get over the fence. No matter what, don't throw the ball over the fence. And of course, first toss. Didn't I tell you not to throw the ball over the fence? And I just chewed his little butt up one side and down the other. Now I'm new. Cut me a little slack. Sent him into his room. Gah, I didn't hit him. I'm getting better. Gah. He went home with his mama, and the next day I snuck around the block and got my ball. Came back in the backyard and went out to play, and I'll be damned. You know, I didn't do that on purpose. And neither did man. You know, and that's how my God works in my life. Just little simple things like that. You know, two votes, Otto. You got two votes. Wake up. You know? He didn't mean to throw the ball over the fence. Stop acting like your father, Otto. You know, I know you want to. You don't know how. I'll show you. I'll show you. Next time I saw, you know, what's sad is after I'd scolded Matt that evening, I'd gone in and to do my little 10-step inventory at the end of the day, you know, and I'm reflecting on my day, and I think about my episode with Matt, and at the end of it, I concluded I had a pretty good day. Because you just don't know till you know. But God will show me. God will show me if I'm willing to see. And that's continued through all my relationships. All my relationships have been healed and made whole. When I buried my father a few years ago, I buried a loved one, not a lovable one. I buried a man I had known the joy of loving for many years. He never changed. He got worse. He was barred from every tavern and bar in Oklahoma City. He had to go out of town to drink. He was so vulgar and so nasty when he would drink. But I could sit with my dad in a tavern, scratch his old burr head, and in his drunken stupor, tell him I loved him. And his words no longer hurt me. And he still harbored those resentments. You remember when you brought those house papers from your mother for me to sign? No, Dad, but get it out. Throw it on out there, Dad. Why, I can't believe you did that for her. And I said, well, you know, Dad, I was just doing the best I could. You know, and his words just didn't hurt me anymore, you know. God took his power away, and he gave his power to me. You know, I can go anywhere. I can do anything. When I lay down at night, I go to sleep. You know, I used to lay awake at night and think what I should have said, what they're going to say, what I could have done, what they're going to do. I used to worry about everybody. What are the kids doing? When are they coming home? I mean, my daughter's running around with a crazy guy. My brother's in prison. My other little daughter's climbing out the window. My son doesn't want to go to college. You know, he's dumpster diving and running around following the Grateful Dead. And, oh, my God, what's going to happen, you know? And I'll tell you what happened. You know, the little 15-year-old girl that's pregnant, now she's 35, and she's got a master's degree, and she graduated magna cum laude, and she lives in Colorado Springs, and she's an educational video designer, and she's brilliant, and she's doing wonderful. You know? And my little dumpster diving son lives in Ashland, Oregon. He's the coolest kid you ever met. He's got a beautiful wife and two children, and he's a home builder. And he's a trim carpenter, and he doesn't do anything that isn't the finest. And I couldn't be more proud of him. And my wife and I just had all five of the grandkids for a week. You know, and they had a ball, and my kids let me take those, or happy to let me take their kids and bring them home. But we had a wonderful, wonderful time. You know, I have a family that resembles the family I always wanted. It never manifested in my family of origin. God, I'm sorry I talked so long. I have just wonderful things to tell you that God has done. But I'll close with the fact that they told me if I could ever go 10 years without infection, I'd be a candidate for a prosthetic hip, an artificial hip. But I couldn't go a year, 2 years max, and then the pus would start to run out of me again. And I lived with chronic pain every day. I would sleep with 8-10 pillows, trying to find a position, you know, where I could find some comfort and some relief. And it just got worse and worse and worse. Well, when I came to Al-Anon and began to practice these principles in all my affairs, when I began to stop feeling so responsible, when that tension was relieved from me, when that anxiety and that fear was relieved from me, when I stopped climbing ladders to look over the fence and see what they were doing so I could call the police, when I just, you know, got inside of my little hula hoop and took care of just that area right there, you know, and when I stopped trying to live by rules that I wanted to make up and started living by the rules as they're given, you know, I'm a disabled person. I never walked with a cane before I came to you. I never parked in a handicapped parking space before I came to you. I always treated myself as a challenged person, someone who has to overcome this disability. You know, and I bowled and I played golf and I did all these things. Well, I don't do those things today. And am I a lesser person because I don't? No. Because when I stopped abusing myself physically, when I stopped stressing and worrying about everything, everyone under the sun, what happened was I got healthy. A big part of the Al-Anon recovery process is taking care of ourselves. Stop worrying about everybody else. God's got it covered, folks. Take care of ourselves. And as I've taken care of myself, I healed. And 10 years after I came to you, I'm 10 years without infection. For 28 years, I had not sat in a chair. For 28 years, I had not touched my left foot. For 28 years, I was straight up and down. I don't bend. All the furniture in my home is custom furniture. It's all bar height. The dining room table is bar height. I sit on bar stools so I can sit on my right cheek and sit at the table with everyone else. Because when I sit in a conventional chair, I sit like this. I can't ride in the back seat of a car. I can't ride a bicycle. I can't do any of those things. But 10 years after I came to you, I was 10 years without infection, and a very courageous doctor started a very long and painful process that didn't go well, but it resulted in me having a hip today. I can drive a standard transmission. I'm pain-free. There's nothing, absolutely nothing in this world that my God can't take care of for me. I've never been happier, healthier, more whole physically, emotionally, socially, legally, financially, maritally, parentally. I've never been healthier. I'm absolutely delighted to be me and to have my limitations and my skills. and to be amongst you and a grateful member of the Al-Anon Family Groups. Thank you.